expectations, predictions in a really strong sense. So then the problem is I have this radical sensory motor and active framework and I want to apply predictive processing to it, but one I went to great lengths to reject representation, and then I'm using predictive processing which requires representation. So the potential problem there is that I want to reject representation and use predictive processing, but predictive processing requires representation, so can I use it? And I was just trying to say yes.
Just following on that, can I just ask you to go back on the previous slide? Yeah, that one. I'm just like trying to understand whether I got this right. So the first point, you're trying to imply that you may not have a representation like in its most proper sense, but you can have something that acts as a fiction or a representation of some sort of, I don't know, a pseudo representation, if that makes sense.
Well, not really, but I can see, I could elaborate on that more because I can see why you think that's because of the way I spoke to it. So, basically, there's these people in philosophers of science who have applied Kendall Walton's make believe account of fiction to models in science. So, in Kendall Walton's account, if you imagine a child playing burrs in the wood, in this imaginative game, a tree stump counts as a burr. So, the child can go around and say, you ask the child, how many burrs did you see? And say, I saw four, like two big ones, two small ones. The burrs don't actually exist. Obviously, it's an imaginative game, but you can use that imaginative game to understand things about the world. So you can understand how many tree stumps are in that wood, how big they are, stuff like that. And the idea, so Walton calls these generative principles. So you have a fictional game like Burrs in the Wood. It has principles such as if there's a tree stump that's big, it will be a big burr, etc. And the idea basically is that you could treat representational posits of predictive processing in the exact same way. So you might say that the fiction, like key Bayesian brain as representational prediction machine, has these sorts of consequences, whereas if you're using a representational explanation, then such and such will follow. And I actually do have another paper on this, but basically there's this guy, Arnon Levy, who's applied this make-believe approach to fictional posits or representational posits in biology, and he's outlined four generative principles or rules that follow from this biological game, and I basically have taken that and applied it to the brain. Hopefully, I mean, because that's a different paper, but hopefully you understand better more what that was my fault, I didn't explain it properly, but so the idea there is that it would be a different theory, but the idea is there is that if you treat representational posits as fictional in that way, it's not like in a bad sense or anything, just they play just the way like an economist would assume that all human agents are perfectly rational. That's like, obviously no human is perfectly rational, but you can use that to make explanations, and the idea is that representation plays the same role here. There's no representation in the brain, but treating the brain as if it's a representation machine can help you, like the actual scientist, understand what's going on. It helps you track events in the brain. So.
Yeah, okay, that really highlights one of the things I wanted to ask you about, challenge you on, in fact. So I don't think this analogy to the econs, perfectly rational economic agents, or the frictionless sphere, is going to have the logic that you want it to have. Because in both those cases, a real system can be described in terms of how close it is to the ideal, right? We know that humans aren't entirely rational agents, but we know that they're partially rational agents, right? So there's some fact of the matter about it in the case of the real sphere on the real plane as well. We can quantify how much it deviates from the frictionless case, and we can say that it is approximately frictionless to this to such and such a degree. It seems to me you're probably not going to want to make the claim that the brain really is representational to such and such a degree, right? It's 98% representational. You don't want to be committed to making claims like that.
I agree that, but I think that fits my favour, because like Andy Clark even specifically talks about, and Michael Rescorla has a paper on it about what it means, like. Predictive processing models use approximations to Bayesian. They don't actually use like the full-blown stuff. And that's why I mentioned the intentional stance. You know, like Dennett said, things might, like parts of the brain aren't literally believers, desires, or they don't have pain, but they can be treated sort of as if they do, and he thinks that ultimately gets cashed out in just neurons either firing or not firing. And I'm basically trying to say the same thing with representation, which is that they do things at the neuronal level. There's actually nothing approaching representation. As you get to more clusters, there's things that get closer and closer to it, but it's not representation. It's not like full-blown prediction.
Not full, but
it's an approximation. Like it's, but if it's an approximation,
if it's an approximation, then it might empirically turn out to be the case that the brain is very, very nearly representational indeed. In the same sense that an empirical sphere or an empirical surface could be very, very nearly.
Exactly. So that's why you accept fictionalism, because you accept fictionalism.
But that's not fictionalism. There's a fact of the matter. The ball either is, you know, nearly frictionless or it isn't.
I don't really know if I agree with it. Well, certainly it's like fictionalism understood in philosophy. That's like a canonical what fictionalism is. If something's indispensable in everyday use, but you have reasons to be suspect of it, you get fictionalism where it doesn't literally exist, but it gets treated as a theoretical posit. So,
but I'm suggesting that philosophical attitude is not nuanced enough. It doesn't take account of the difference between things that are merely qualitative, distinctions that are merely qualitative, and distinctions that are quantitative. Right? I'm asserting that it's difficult to be fictionalist about these idealized posits in some strong sense, because you find yourself inevitably committed to the idea that, you know, well, maybe this idea of being frictionless is a fiction, but the idea of being nearly frictionless is not a fiction at all, right? That's not a fiction.
Well, how would you explain, like, a centre of gravity? You wouldn't say, you can't point to a centre of gravity, but you can still...
Well, I can't point to the mass of an object, but I think that's real as well. I don't think that centres of gravity are fictional.
Oh, okay.
You can empirically establish a centre of gravity.
Yeah. But what's like ontological status?
That's what Simon's saying, isn't it? That although it doesn't kind of exist in a really hard sense, it can be established empirically.
But nor does mass. I mean,
nor does hard
objects,
yeah.
Right? They don't exist in a really... None of these things exist in any stronger sense than centres of gravity.
But isn't this covered by his useful fictionalism?
I'm making the claim that these properties, these constructs like a centre of mass, that fictionalism is the wrong way to think about them, unless you're prepared to be fictionalist about every attribute of the empirical world.
But I think, like, once Adrian's defined his use of fictionalism as a matter, and you can disagree about whether everything falls under his definition of fictionalism, maybe about two kinds of fictionalism or something like that, but I think is the way that he is using the term here.
Basically, everyone in philosophy of science uses the
right,
term.
And people will use examples like the centre of gravity as an example of the kind of fictionalism that Adrian's talking about. You might disagree with that, but I think he uses them to find like better analogies to help illustrate the point.
But yeah, there's...
But are there any more fiction? I guess this is a point I wanted to raise, but just following on from this. So are neurons any less?
No, they are equivalent to the tree stumps.
I don't understand how that's not an idealization that reality doesn't support. So reality doesn't really support neurons.
Okay, so now this is like it. So I understand what you're saying. So when I'm using fictionalism, I'm not like talking about really metaphysical far ideas, but what's the nature? Is it all like a superposition of equiprobable states, or whatever? Basically, Walton, his food thing is you have objects which act as props in games of make-believe. So a book is one, the words are props, and they allow you to make sort of imaginative inferences. Similarly, the tree stumps are props which allow you to play them. And my claim is basically the brain is a prop in the representational fiction. So I'm not saying that brains don't exist or whatever. I'm just saying representation is a fictional posit on the brain, which actually is real.
Yeah, and I was saying that maybe I'm not accepting the make-believe approach, because there are a lot of scientists who don't think they're playing a game of make-believe. They actually do think the things that they, the best explanatory elements, in other words, it's not like them deciding, let's just say there are bears. They look at the data and they come up with the best explanation for what they've observed, and they said, hey, it looks like there are bears in this wood. And so they're not, it's not a whimsical, like, let's just pretend that this is this. Well, then, of course, if they were doing that, then you could replace the talk about bears with talk about tree stumps, no loss of anything.
Well, yeah.
But the claim here is that there's a disanalogy. It's not a good analogy. It's not a good account of what's going on in science, because it's not like there already is a prior understanding of what really exists, and then we're going to have this whimsical add-on that might have some practical value. This is our best attempt at what is in the forest, of understanding what is in the forest. It's the stump.
Well, the answer to that is, if you're a fictionalist, you can either be a hermeneutic fictionalist or a revolutionary fictionalist. A hermeneutic fictionalist says that this is what scientists were already doing and they realize they're doing it. Or if you're a revolutionary fictionalist, you say scientists don't think they're doing this, but you should revolutionize the discourse and say that, well, this is actually what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I don't see any problem with that, because, some scientists, Newton might have thought he was discovering gods, God something or other. But it doesn't mean that you need to take it that that's what he was actually doing. Like, it's not clear to me that scientists always, they obviously know what they're doing, but it's not clear to me that just because they think they're using representation in this term, they necessarily are. They might not be.
Problem with the second approach is that you need an argument. So you need some reason to believe that they're wrong about what they think.
Because
exists.
Representation is like, you need to explain then how the brain squirts out consciousness, so you get the mind-body problem. You need to naturalize representation at the neuronal level.
I mean, the whole point about PP is that it gets you, it has a softer, more accommodating notion of representation, which avoids all that.
It doesn't. It specifically defines, conscious perception as unconscious inferences are about the nature of external stimuli. So nominologically, you can have unconscious representations. So there's no necessary connection between physical and phenomenal. So there's a problem of why this experience exists at all.
Yeah, go ahead, Simon.
I am strongly convinced that the project of understanding cognition scientifically does not in and of itself have to account for phenomenology. Right?
For what?
For phenomenology. Right? So I think that the there are reasons why the physical behaviour of cognitive systems is the way it is, and there are reasons why particular ways are a good way to understand it physically that hold, even if you're prepared to countenance the existence of zombies, or indeed, if you think that questions about, or indeed, if you're a mysterian, right, about phenomenology. So it seems to me that cognitive science shouldn't proceed from a base of it being required that all these theories account for phenomenal experience.
Well, I get what you're saying, but is that not quite revisionary? Because, at least as far as I'm aware, since Marr and onwards, the whole idea of visual science is explain how you get from, 2D information to, full-blown 3D experience. So it seems to me that's what you're trying to explain.
I don't think so at all. I mean, if you look at it, the agenda is quite, for at least, if that's Marr's intention, it's not the intention that is supported by his work, right? Because you could quite reasonably ask, if you were a cognitivist, you could say, no, the problem is how you go from two-dimensional information to a three-dimensional representation.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's it. That's the question. No.
Okay. That's fair enough. Yeah, that's true. I guess I'm interested in just in conscious experience, and predictive processing, again, does say you don't perceive the representation, you perceive the content of representation, but how do you perceive the content of a...
But have you just helped yourself to a straw man version of representation?
I don't think so.
I mean, and also, are you ever going to be able to get representation out of PP? I mean, the essence of PP is the hierarchical Bayesian prediction machine. That's just clearly, you know, a representational object.
Yeah.
So representing, you know, data at different levels of
granularity. No, I think that's why I prefer fictionalism, because I think that representation is indispensable to predict processing. But we were talking about this earlier, actually, but I think as well that's an empirical matter too. So basically you would need to take...
So they're not like bears. Bears are not essential when dealing with the woods. It's an add-on that you can throw away. But now we've got a case where our best account, the representations are more like the stumps. We can't really understand what's going on out there, and said, unless we talk about it in terms of trees and stumps. And so I don't see how the model you gave of fictionalism doesn't seem to match well with what you're saying about the indispensability.
Well, basically, I have like one example where I've taken some predictive processing work. It's like Hugo Critchley's and Anil Seth's and a few other people. They have a 2002 paper, and they have like a diagram of predictive processing, and they explain they got it from a diagram from this guy called Wang. And then I sort of like follow his stuff. But basically, I've like tried. Maybe I should just like have given that paper then. But basically, I tried to apply that paper and say, look, as you ascend from single neurons to like the full-blown predictive processing thing, representational idioms become more prevalent. But all they're doing is allow you to abstract away from your physiological detail. So But what I'm saying about the empirical thing is that I've applied that to one example. But what you'd have to do is apply that to work in predictive processing and then see if it can be explained that way. So you might be right, maybe, because I haven't really had time to do this yet, but I do want to go back and look at other examples of predictive processing and see. And yet you may be right that I could apply that example of fictionalism to that one case, but maybe when I apply it to other cases, it doesn't really work. So yeah, I guess like that's just...
Johnny's been waiting a while. So.
So just to rewind a little bit, so I kind of meant a comment on the conversation as it was about 5 minutes ago. I think like there's a kind of dialectical problem here where Adrian has in mind these already sort of established problems of naturalizing, you know, properties of representation at the subpersonal level, and he kind of doesn't want to have to talk about those in his talk. He can sort of bracket those and then say, well, you know, given these problems, here's how I think you go about it. So that is maybe a sort of, yeah, a difficulty in sort of the context
that
you're presenting it in. And okay, so putting that aside for a moment, just so I'm kind of sympathetic to fictionalism, broadly speaking, although I mostly try to be agnostic about the metaphysics of representation. And I have one worry about fictionalism, and it's kind of a methodological worry rather than a kind of conceptual worry. And so the problem is that, so for me, the thing that with representation talk and evaluating its appropriateness or its legitimacy is that first and foremost what you need to do is kind of clean out your conceptual cover. So you need to say, right, what work is the notion of representation doing here? Is it a useful notion? And importantly, do we have a grip on the notion such that it's not just like being used really trivially, that it's lost all kind of explanatory cover? So ideally what you want is a kind of account of representation, a definition of representation that usefully captures a certain kind of functional role. And then you can go into your metaphysics. That's sort of the position I'm adopting at the moment anyway. Now, I'm absolutely fine with fictionalism. I think you can kind of like plug fictionalism into that. But one of my worries, at least sort of anecdotally, is that when you have fictionalism about representations, sometimes the fictionalist doesn't do the first part. So because they can kind of go, oh, well, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter because I don't have to worry about the metaphysics, they end up not doing the first part, which is to see, well, is representation really playing any kind of useful role? So ironically, even though you're kind of coming from this anti-representational background, you end up legitimizing too much representation talk, because you kind of convince yourself that all representation talk is fine because it's not going to be a problem for your metaphysics. I don't know how I'm explaining myself very...
No, I do understand. So you're basically saying by being a fictionalist, you've already let representation in the door, and then it's sort of hard to explain why you should avoid it.
Right.
Yeah, well, that's, I suppose like that's the old problem of fictionalism. It's like both sides attack you because you're being too...
and I had some particular point to make that's related to predictive processing, but I can't remember all the time. It was a very smart comment.
Could you just go right back to step one and remind us why you're trying to get rid of
representation.
No, but that's for Johnny asked us to set that aside for. I mean, I think that's a different talk. The problems of representationalism and yeah. So this is saying, assume that you've already got a problem with representation. By the way, I think by representation you both mean subpersonal representation, right?
Yes.
Because,
yeah.
Because you say, well, there's knowledge, there's sensory motor knowledge.
Yes,
so that's on a personal level, so there could be a notion of, yes, we represent the world
right.
or something. But subpersonal representation is problematic. It would take too long to go over those problems. You can talk about it over lunch, whatever. But given those problems, what can you do? Well, you can be radical sensory motor and activist,
maybe,
and you can use predictive processing this way, and yes, you've got the problem that the PP is maybe using representations, but actually it's only... It's you can be fictionalist about it. So that's how you're trying to put this picture together. And I think Johnny's right. I think for the purposes of today, we shouldn't necessarily be asking Adrian to go over the arguments against
representations. But even on that, because I'll be given this talk, maybe I didn't make that clear enough, so would it be helpful if I made very clear why
the original.
Or just to make clear that you're not going to be assuming that.
Yeah.
And
okay.
But even if with the picture that I've sketched out, I think that there's the personal level, and you're criticizing a subpersonal account that's representational. I think there's a tension that you haven't addressed, which is. So the way you put it, look, it's straightforward. It's no metaphysical problems. Consciousness is kind of behavior. Brains control behavior. End of story. What's the problem? And you seem to be aware, okay, maybe that's too quick. Maybe people say it's reductionist. But here's how it's not just a matter of, I'm jealous of you being able to do that so easily because I've got all this baggage I need to get. No, here's why we representationalists have all the extra baggage and we don't have that clear picture. It's because... there's a problem there. What is it about how the brain controls behavior that matches so well the consciousness story? In other words, there's a personal level story and there's a subpersonal level story. And of course, we all know that the subpersonal story makes possible the personal level story. But that's not the end of the story. It's the beginning of the question. What is it? How is it that this brain activity and the way it controls behavior, how does it give rise to this way of experiencing the world as opposed to that way of experiencing the world? And one way to do it is to appeal to the kinds of information that's being processed, the kinds of information that's being attended to and not being attended to, the kinds of ways of representing the world, and that way you can explain. I'm not saying it has to be a simple, McDowell talked about a welling up. It doesn't have to be that. For every personal level content, there is some subpersonal level content that wins the race and becomes the personal level. That's a very simplistic first pass at an idea, but there might be some more complex story about how the sub-representational contents get fused into or explain a personal level content. But we see that as a challenge that needs to be, that's a possible answer to the question, how is it that personal level contents, experiences, knowledge, whatever. How are they enabled by the lower level stuff? Well, we have an answer. I don't see the sensory motor and activist just saying it just does. When you have this knowledge, that when we have this sensory motor skill, it just does make enable experience of a certain kind. Well, how? Why is it that kind of experience as opposed to that kind of experience? The predictive processing approach, and in particular the kind of expectation based version of that I'm interested in. Says quite clearly, it's because the content of the expectations is this, that the contents of the personal level experience will be this. And so at least there's a very concrete proposal, whereas I don't find, when you go non-representational, how you're able to predict from the low level, the subpersonal account, what the phenomenal contents will be. There's no way to, and therefore no way to explain them.
Oh yeah, you won't, but you'll explain them via the relation between organism and environment, and that's just like, stuff that No Way talks about, and Susan Hurley in No Way have a paper on it about the way visual stimulus has this certain no-light relation. Or I don't know, if I hear something, closing my eyes won't really affect it, but closing your eyes will affect vision. So the idea is that there's a law-like relation between different modes of so they talk about I can't remember the comparative gap. So why experience is one way as opposed to the other? It's due to the law-like relation between sensation and movement, and because that gets all cashed out via behavior and stuff, you're explaining because those experiences are a type of behavior. So I sort of think you could explain that.
Yeah. Well. Okay. I've said enough. I'm not convinced. So if they do have an account, I think it is implicitly representationalist. I think they're going to appeal to information and ways of presenting information in order to explain why it's this kind of personal love experience as opposed to that one.
Ryle had a view that's like very similar to theirs, except he didn't emphasize the object, the environment in it, and he definitely does not require personal representation of content, so if he doesn't, then
if you and they want to throw your hands in with Ryle, that's fine.
Oh no, they don't, I do. That's the thing, like, they do not agree with this because I'm going too far back to... That's why I said everyone disagrees that bit, because they don't like...
We're 2 minutes over now, so I'm afraid we have to... are you planning to go to lunch? I've brought my own lunch, so I might have to go away and microwave it and then join you later. I don't know if they have a microwave there, but let's... please join us for lunch if you like, but let's thank Adrian before we go.
Awareness is perception is understanding.
Yeah.